This is Dubai Eye 103.8.
The region's favourite doctors, live and listening.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Not one doctor, but two in the studio this afternoon. Dr. Ahmed Aboutoun is here, clinical molecular geneticist and director of the Al Jalila Genomics Centre, along with Dr. Alan Taylor, genetic counsellor, here to talk about genetics and everything we need to know about our health. This could be problems you're concerned about currently, or maybe you're thinking about issues in your family. This is your chance to get some questions answered. Dr. Ahmed is the director of the genetics laboratory at Al Jalila, completed his PhD at Dartmouth, followed by a fellowship at Dartmouth, and then went to Harvard. So some pretty big education in the room. And Dr. Allen has his master's from Northwestern University, extensive experience in epilepsy and neurometabolic conditions too. So I'm basically going to be asking all the questions that are on your minds, everyone else. We're going to be busting through a bit of jargon, hopefully. And if anything comes up that we're not sure about, I'll be the one to ask the so-called silly questions. Welcome, doctors. Great to have you with
us.
Thank you. So, yeah, I really want to go back to basics, given that I wasn't even sure how to pronounce genomics until about 25 minutes ago. Where are you at when it comes to genetics here in the UAE, Dr. Ahmed? What kind of issues are you seeing coming into clinic?
So maybe, first of all, just give a simple definition of what genomics is.
Yes, please.
And so genomics is simple, in simple terms, is the study of the genomes. And the genome term defines the genetic material that's found in every one of our cells. And it's basically the instruction manual. It's a book that has instructions for how we look, how we react, how every molecule in our cells is functioning, and if something goes wrong, how it can be repaired. And basically, the genomic material is made up of DNA. And the DNA itself is a code of four letters. It's ATGC that is repeated several times in multiple combinations. There are some changes between all of us in terms of this code, and this is what makes us all different and unique. And if we stretch all those bases in one single cell, it would be around 3 billion letters long.
Wow.
So you could imagine the complexity of the DNA in our bodies. This DNA has some functional units called genes. The genes are units that code for proteins that make up our cells structurally, but also tell our cells how to function. Now, there are normal variations, like I mentioned, that makes our eye colors different, our nose shapes different, our hair color different. But sometimes there are occasionally and very rarely errors that happen that might cause disease.
Mm-hmm.
We can maybe discuss this further later, but this is just a brief introduction of genomics.
Do you know what came to my mind then? I was thinking about Jurassic Park. They're like, it's the building blocks of life.
Jurassic Park did a good job at introducing DNA.
Good, and like the little animatronics
or little cartoons they had.
I'm so embarrassed that's the context that I have.
In fact, we're just talking about this. Sometimes we find it's easier to get this idea across when you use cartoons rather than descriptions, because it's quite difficult. So that's what genetic counselling is. As a genetic counsellor, I'm not actually a doctor. So that's always a misconception. So I don't want anybody calling in looking for a geneticist when they come to Al Jalila. So a master's in genetic counselling, our role is to try and break down these concepts to families, because it is a big thing. If you go for genetic testing, you have a diagnosis. You don't want to be so bogged down in the jargon that you lose the message that you're getting across about the family.
Mm-hmm.
So like Dr. Ahmed was saying about the overall description of genetics, the way I would use to break it down is that the DNA is, there's four letters of DNA, the same way in the English alphabet there's 26, in the Arabic alphabet there's 28. So if we put these into a sentence, we can call them a recipe in our alphabets, but in the DNA alphabet's a gene. And like you said, the color of our eyes is a good example. So changes in the recipes tells what color our eyes are. Then if we, again, if we use an analogy of writing, where we've got a recipe, if we put all the recipes into a book, that's called a chromosome. And we get one of our chromosomes from our mother's and one from our father's, and we've got 23 pairs. So to give you an idea, that's where a blend of our parents, because we get half of it from each side. So then if we went from the letter to the recipe to the book, we also have a library. And that's an entire set of chromosomes. So if you take any one of our cells, say a brain cell, a heart cell, an eye cell, a skin cell, they will all contain the same library. So even though each part of our body is doing something different, they all contain the same genetic code. And like Dr. Ahmed was saying, it's 3 billion letters that compose our genome. So it's a lot to try and interpret. And we don't know everything yet in 2019, but we're making progress there.
I feel like huge progress in the last couple of years and AI coming in, and we're talking about, you know, specific customized medicine in the future and probably no doubt going on in some parts of the world and in some industries as well. We've got two experts in the studio this afternoon to answer your questions relating to genetics. So can I ask you, Al-Jalila, what kind of issues are you treating and coming up against, Dr. Ahmed?
Like Ellen mentioned, the 20,000 genes or the code, you know, the DNA is found in every cell in our body. But different organ systems use different combinations of the genes, right? So if there is neuronal cells in your brain, we'll use some gene products that are different from the epithelial cells on your skin. If there are certain mutations in a gene that's expressed in your skin, you will have a dermatological disorder, but if you have a mutation or a disease-causing variant in a gene that is used in your brain, then you'll have a neurological disorder like seizures or epilepsy. So what ends up happening is that those patients with genetic disorders are going into those specialty genetics clinics. If, you know, it's either endocrinology, if you have a mutation in a gene affecting your thyroid gland, or if a neurology clinic, if you have a mutation affecting the brain cells. But the underlying cause is really genetic in nature. And then what we're seeing is that those patients come there, but then the doctors who are non-geneticists need support and access to genetic services to be able to work those up and identify a diagnosis that one will help the patient understand what syndrome they're dealing with. And if there are some therapies, you can target it. And you mentioned customized or personalized medicine. And genomics is the underlying foundation of this whole new field because of the new technological advances. We're able to identify those DNA changes much easier. And you also, because we are in the Middle East, our family structure is different. We have very big families, on average 4 to 5 kids per family. So each diagnosis becomes an opportunity to counsel that family about the recurrence risk. So there are, and that's again a common theme at any pediatric hospital, including Al-Jalila, and worldwide, and especially in the Middle East. So then you need to tell the family if you have a mutation for a recessive gene, and a recessive means, like Alan was explaining, you have one complement of DNA from mom and another complement from dad. Those diseases, both copies are affected. And therefore, there is always a 25% chance that the second pregnancy will also be affected. So the family needs to be aware of the risks, because there are also opportunities to, like pre-implantation genetic diagnosis or in vitro fertilization to try to limit or reduce the number of incidences.
We're going to be talking about reproductive and some of the impact on that. So any questions relating to that, you're more than welcome to get in touch. Or if you're concerned about a diagnosis you've had, perhaps you want a bit of genetic counselling to help you cut through the jargon. This is your chance. Alan Taylor joining us this afternoon, Dr. Ahmed from Al-Jalila Children's. This is it's a complicated subject, Alan. What drew you to genetics?
Back when I first did my undergrad, it was back in Ireland, I actually did focus, my major was in genetics. So ever since from high school, there's always an interest. I originally thought I was going to do a PhD and go down the same route as Dr. Ahmed, but after years of doing it, I realized, number one, I wasn't very good at research, and number two, I didn't like it.
Okay, so it's a no.
Yes, I'm a bit of a slow learner in that aspect. But I heard about genetic counseling when I was an undergrad, and I learned about it again during my years of working in a research laboratory. And I got the opportunity to shadow a genetic counselor. And then I got my own counseling experience doing charity work when I was living in the States. So because of that, I liked the whole interactions of dealing with people and helping through difficult situations. Mm-hmm. And since I've got the background in genetics, that is a passion. So rather than dealing with in a lab all day and looking at petri dishes, I got to talk to people about these topics.
And increase understanding and awareness.
Yes, yes.
Speaking of awareness, a message here from Paul in 4001 saying, thinking about buying a genetics test online, what do I need to know before spending? This has exploded in the last couple of years. And you can get them from Amazon, you can get them from specialist websites. The States especially is passionate about it. They're using it for, like, you know, someone uploaded their details and now we've caught their, you know, their great uncle from a napkin, you know, on this crime watch. You know, it's gone crazy. What do we need to know about at-home testing? What information can they share? Are they worth spending on?
I think we could nearly spend an entire podcast on that. In this, our particular work we're doing in Al Jalila, we just want to differentiate that. It's very different. The way we compare it to direct-to-consumer, it's a pregnancy test versus an ultrasound. One's a medical test, one is something you can buy at home. Mm-hmm. My views on DTC, I think they're fun. I think something like Ancestry.com will tell you about your heritage. It's interesting to talk about your family history in that aspect. So in terms of when you learn about, say, your fitness or your issues to what kind of food you metabolize, the data and research around some, so when we're talking about these things, what they're looking at is particular changes within your genome, like I said, the colors of your eyes. For a lot of the data, for a lot of these research, it's not well established. So just because we found one change in someone who's healthy doesn't mean that change is necessarily the cause of change or why they're healthy, or someone is overweight and that's why they're overweight. So because of that, I wouldn't put much confidence in these tests. And second of all, this, I'm sure you can always do your research. And if Paul is interested in doing his research, because you're selling, you're giving your DNA to a private company, you have to understand what they can do with that DNA afterwards. Can they sell that to a pharmaceutical company for extracting data? So I think that's the number one question people should be asking.
Proceed with
your
caution.
Privacy, I think, yes.
I hope that helps, Paul. But while I've got you in the studio, we're going to get through some questions as soon as we can. But I just feel like, you know, you guys are on the cutting edge of genetics here in the region. We're seeing some really interesting developments in all sorts of areas, from reproduction, but also in entertainment and sport. And I just wondered, what role do genetics play in sport? You know, the way certain genes are expressed in the body can obviously influence an athlete's strength or endurance, making them better suited to sprinting or marathons. But there's ethical questions around it as well. You know, should potential Olympians have their genome sequenced as a way of identifying talent? Michael Phelps is obviously the one that springs to mind, Alan. You know, he's scientifically proven that his body produces only half the lactic acid that his rivals need to handle, so it significantly improves his recovery time. What do you think the future holds, and what are the implications?
I think it's always going to be inevitable when we see somebody like Michael Phelps or Usain Bolt, who are just naturally exceptional individuals, that we want to know what the genetic basis of it. Generally, when we're trying to find changes like this, we want to have large populations of this to do it. One patient is usually not enough to find a specific change. Ultimately, I think the future is we'll have more understanding of what genes affect how athletes are so good. I don't think there's anything unethical about that. It may be the point we're getting to the future, we do genetic editing, but we're far away from that. And that's a whole other ethical nightmare. But I think, does genetics play a part? Of course. But does lifestyle play a part as well? Without a doubt.
And I'm guessing, you know, you guys having a specialty in children as well, is it going to get to the point where you've got, you know, young aspiring Olympians training hard and then equally, you know, a testing element saying, do you know what, you're the one that's got the chance to go far, but you guys haven't got a chance?
I think
probably already happening in some countries.
this might also fall back into the direct-to-consumer testing. I think, like Ellen had already mentioned, the science, supporting this is not yet there. I don't think we yet have a test with a clinical utility to test any children or like any athletes to say, based on that information, you're going to do well on this exercise or not. So there's nothing unethical about it, like Alan was saying, but I think we still need more evidence to
watch
support
this space.
That. Yeah.
Let's get some questions. Sarah's asking on 4001, is there such a thing as genetic tests for learning difficulties? On my husband's side, his mother has three brothers who have severe learning disabilities to the extent they live in sheltered accommodation in the UK and have done all their adult lives. His mother seems to have some emotional difficulties and or mild learning disabilities, but there's been no official diagnosis. My husband also has two brothers, one of whom demonstrates some signs but hasn't been diagnosed. Can my husband go to the doctor and ask for genetic testing for any inherited conditions? I'm quite sure his mother would object to going herself. Is there such a test, and what would it involve?
What I would recommend for them is actually meet a genetic counsellor. If they're in Dubai itself, there's not many. If they're back in England, there's more access. There's only two genetic counsellors, certified genetic counsellors within this region. Well, if we're in Dubai. But if you're back in England, it may be a better opportunity to go speak to them, because what a genetic counsellor does will look at your family history. It'll take a detailed family history. They'll look at how anything's been inherited to your family. And ideally, if we're looking for genetic diagnosis and changes, we want to test somebody who's actually affected. not somebody who's unaffected. So if her husband's unaffected, he wouldn't be the best person to start with. And even then, very often, if it's only a learning difficulty, it may be even a case of genetic counselling and say, maybe it's not relevant, we shouldn't do genetic testing. But I recommend that they find a genetic specialist and look at the family history and say whether it's warranted in this case.
Hope that helps, Sarah. Wishing you all the best. So reproductive technology, this is available in many forms in the region that can be gender selection. Are we even seeing this kind of selection when it comes down to really specific variants of disease as well, Alan?
Yes. For this case, when we find somebody, the family's born, and they know they're a carrier for a condition, or two, the child is born, they find this child has got this recessive condition where the parents both carry the change, but since they've only got one copy, it's not sufficient to cause the condition. What they can do is they can actually do testing during the pregnancy, where they test the actual fetus itself and find a diagnosis. Or two, the preventive way of doing it is to go through IVF, selecting a number of embryos, and they can test the embryo directly to see if they've got the that change. If they don't, then they implant those embryos and continue the pregnancy that way.
So the ones that do have that would be discarded?
Discarded.
Right.
And we're seeing this in the region, Dr. Ahmed?
Yes, I think, and especially in UAE, I've seen a lot of IVF clinics. And I think the most important thing and the first step in this is to identify the specific mutation. And this begins with ordering the right genetic test. And once we know what are those genetic variants or changes, like Ellen was mentioning, you can do IVF and then do genetic testing on the embryos and select the ones that don't carry those specific variants that you would then go ahead and do the implantation for.
I said, you know, it sounds like science fiction. It does.
It's happening.
It's a bit like, you know, Gattaca, you know, where they're kind of selecting astronauts. It really is.
Right.
Yeah. I think, you know, concerns that have been raised in media and with experts is that, you know, the wealthy become more healthy because they're able to afford such, you know, treatments and precautions. Some ethical questions that need to be asked and huge implications down the line.
Right. That's actually a common question. And the National Institute of Health in the United States actually dedicates a certain budget for orphan disease disorders. Those are diseases that are underrepresented. And what really is happening, like you mentioned, you have a rich family with a newborn with a rare disorder. This family is able to advocate for that disease. They're able to raise awareness about it. They make, funding associations. They might fund a group of scientists to do more research about that specific condition. And then you end up with, biased availability of therapeutic tools for rich families and not the poor families. And so you're absolutely right. And because of this, you know, we should also raise awareness and, dedicate some funding and for those rare disorders that are also found outside, you know, the more rich families. So,
question that's come in here saying, my daughter, age 2.5, is born without nails. She's our second child. Our first son, age 4.5, is perfectly normal. We're a Pakistani family wondering what are the chances for a third child if we decide to go for it having this issue. Me and my wife are cousins, meaning our mothers are sisters. Thank you. So born without nails, first child doesn't have this issue. What comes to mind right there, Dr. Ahmed?
So there are a group of conditions called ectodermal dysplasias, and this might be one of them. I think the advice is for this family to see a genetic specialist or with the help with a genetic counseling with any specialty clinic that it might have a look at this kid. They should order the right, it's called a gene panel that contains a list of genes that are known to cause, you know, ectodermal dysplasias that has, you know, absence of nails and sometimes might affect the sweat glands. Based on the genetic mutation, this can affect a recessive gene. And a recessive gene is where both copies have to be deleted or impacted for it to cause the disease. Or it can be in an X-linked gene. And the X-linked gene, the risk assessment for the next pregnancy will depend on whether this mutation is on the X chromosome or if it's on a recessive gene. So if it's recessive, then 25% chance the next pregnancy will have a child with no nails. But if it's X-linked and the mother is a carrier, and you would expect that there's 50% chance that the boys will have it. So the straight answer is a genetic testing is required to determine where exactly that genetic mutation is. And based on this, the risk assessment plan can be made for the family.
Alan, can I ask you, we're talking about genetic testing there. What does that look like in reality? Are we talking about swabs, blood tests? What could people expect?
So ideally, from a genetic counselling point of view, is that we'd like to counsel a family fully, so we've got informed consent before we actually pursue testing, because there's a lot to know. Mostly when you're doing testing, it's only about the patient and you want to find a cure. For a genetic counsellor's point of view, is that the patient is like the entire family. So you don't want the pet family to come in and get this answer that could impact other family members. And additionally, like I said, in 2019, we don't know everything. So we want to be aware that we could find an answer which is still not diagnostic yet, but with more information comes out. But to cut to the point where you're asking, it's usually it's blood test. Majority of cases, a blood test. From sometimes it's a swab, and the director of consumer testing, like 23andMe or Ancestry.com, they'll usually do a swab.
So for this family, you would recommend coming in, having a full discussion, talking about family history, and proceeding with some tests.
Right, that's right. Usually with a dermatologist as well, somebody who's got some insight. Because I imagine they've got better input.
And we're going to do a quick fire question round, gentlemen. If you're ready, get through as many questions as we can. I enjoy this question from Andrea because it was on my mind too, and I saw how massive my husband's head is. And I was slightly concerned about giving birth. She's asking, late babies and birth weight, are they related to genetics? Expecting my first at Christmas and I found out that all my close relatives were about a week late, some more so. I was late, so is my husband. Does this make genetically more likely that my child will be too? Also, my husband weighed over 5 kilos at birth, hoping that's not genetic either. So do I, Andrew. What do you think, Alan?
So I'll just take a bit on the side. By any chance, is a father Irish? Because my friends told me recently a risk factor having big heads is being of Irish parents.
Really?
Apparently in England that was put up, so...
More than a genetic risk factor.
So, and I do actually have a big head, so I do buy into
that.
We'll
put a photo on Instagram stories.
But going back to answer the person's question, I can't say. I think since it's running the family, it's most likely something happening, but can we say anything particular? I don't know. I'd say her family history says the most about this situation.
Right. Genetic could contribute, but I don't know of a single genetic cause that might explain it, and therefore we can't talk about risk.
Okay. Recurrence. And I would say reflexology if that baby is a bit late, because it worked for me. And a question here from Marham saying, hi there, everyone. My son was diagnosed with autism last month at 4 years old, and I wanted to know about the link between genetics and autism. Is there any point in doing the genetics test? Would it show if me and my husband are carrying a, quote, autism gene? As a friend said recently, the test just goes into a bigger pool of research to try and find out a link. Also, are children born with autism, or is it something that develops later on? That's what my doctor said, that they develop it later. Also, what's the likelihood my second son will be autistic? Lots to unpick there. What are we saying, Dr. Ahmed?
So the answer is yes. There are genetic tests that can identify underlying causes of autism. Some of it is caused by single gene or Mendelian disorders, some of which is more complex where genetic plays a role, but there are other environmental factors that play in. So I would suggest for this family to see the special doctors, and we have a big mental health program at Algeria Children's Specialty Hospital. And I think a recommended first-tier test is also available for this group of patients, which Algeria Children's Hospital also offers. It's called the microarray test. This test should be performed on the autistic child. And based on this, we will understand if there is a genetic Mendelian cause, and then we could discuss again risk, recurrence risk, and define if we need to test parents to see the chances that they might pass it on to the next pregnancy.
And then Alan will be there to decipher all that information.
Yes, I can discuss it. But just from empiric evidence, even if we didn't have a genetic diagnosis, when we find somebody with autism in the family, the chance of it occurring again, it's elevated. Maybe not as much as you may think it is, but there is an increased risk over the general population.
Hope that helps, Mohammed. As Dr. Akhmed said, Al-Jalila's Children's Hospital does have some resources there that could be able to help. While I've got you both in the studio, what do you think are going to be the big breakthroughs we're going to see in genetics over the next couple of years, Doctor?
I think we will see more of genetic therapies. We have been really good at understanding the function of our genomes. The first human genome project was done in 2001, and after this, there has been a proliferation of new tools and new research studies to try to annotate the genome. There are 20,000 genes. We know the clinical significance of only 6,000 of those, but the list is growing. And now we're starting to see gene editing therapies. So spinal muscular atrophy that you mentioned, there is now an available FDA-approved medicine where those patients can have an injection to have this gene back. So I think we will see a proliferation of new genetic therapies. And I'd like actually to also mention in the UAE, there has been a lack of comprehensive genomic centers. And this is actually really key because if you don't have such centers, and by comprehensive, I mean a patient would come see a genetic specialist, they see genetic counselors to tell them about the potential of a genetic factor, and then to do the genetic testing in UAE so we can keep track of a database of those disease mutations that later we can understand better for each disease which mutation is more severe versus not, which mutations can be targeted for therapy or not. And as you may know, each population has different disease landscapes and different genetic mutations. So unless we centralize it in the UAE, we can't build on, you know, understanding which therapies should be targeted. And a key one here also is genetic counseling, because like Alan mentioned, he's the second or maybe the first board-certified genetic counselor in the UAE. I think doing the genetic testing on its own without support might be kind of a disservice. You need the vehicle, and that's genetic counseling, to get this data to the patient and even to the doctors.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon from Al Jalila Children's Hospital, clearing up a few myths there and answering questions too.
This is Dubai Eye 103.8.